I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. It's been two decades since the end of apartheid in South Africa. While its constitution is a model for emerging democracies and it elected its first black president, the country has not fulfilled many of the promises of a non-racial, non-sexist, egalitarian society. That's what our guest Douglas Foster has written based on his visits over a period of 8 years to South Africa and his interviews with government leaders, including the current president, Jacob Zuma, along with his many conversations with South Africans. Foster is the author of a new book called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Half of the country is under the age of 25, and that demographic fact, he says, has big implications for the future of the country. Douglas Foster is director of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, an associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. He was an editor at Mother Jones, a senior editor at the Center for Investigative Reporting. He tried to get here, drive here in his car, and was turned back by all sorts of traffic problems on I-95. But it's a great pleasure, Douglas Foster, to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be with you, Marty.
When did you get interested in South Africa? And I know you've been back and forth many times over the last 8 years or so.
I've been going for 8 years, which puts me there right at the 10-year anniversary of this experiment, one of the globe's newest democracies. But I've been interested ever since I was a college student. Like a lot of people, maybe I was in demonstrations for civil rights and against the Vietnam War, and those pictures, those iconic pictures of Nelson Mandela that people held up, that I held up, of him in his boxing shorts and fighting trim or in skins when he was sentenced to prison, spent 27 years there. And I think, you know, in 1990, when Nelson Mandela made his tour of the world, he showed up in my hometown of Oakland, California, and said, we're going to create this, the kind of society that the world has never seen before, non-sexist, non-racial, egalitarian, non-homophobic. Come and see what we make of it. And 10 years on, I was lucky enough to start going in 2004.
Well, as you write and we'll talk about, this promise of this new South Africa has not been fulfilled.
Right. There's a huge gap between that aspiration and in the mid-90s. Nelson Mandela ran for president on the slogan of peace, period, jobs, period, justice. And I think one-third of that slogan has been achieved. There are so many reasons why it hasn't been achieved. I think it's important that it remains the aspiration, including of young people who didn't grow up during apartheid.
In fact, you say something like half the population is under the age of 25, so has maybe through parents or grandparents know something about apartheid, but doesn't have that personal experience with it.
I think that's right. It's half the population 24 and under, and maybe even more starkly, 40% of the population 18 and under. So for that 40% or half of the population, Nelson Mandela came out of prison as an old man. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any direct experience of the struggle that led to the end of that extreme and peculiar form of racial segregation called apartheid.
Are there, though, vestiges of apartheid?
Sure. You see it in everything from where people are allowed to live and the entwining of race and class that took place under apartheid, more than 40 years of it, and hundreds of years of colonialism, mean that the economic effects of that aligning of race and income are still visible. People talk about spatial apartheid. Sometimes we talk about it in U.S. terms, too, the way in which our cities and states are segregated by race. There's certainly an extreme form of that in South Africa.
Well, thinking about those whites in South Africa that enjoyed the privileges of apartheid, do they still live a more, I won't say charmed, but a privileged life?
Yes, certainly in comparison to the vast majority of the population, 75 to 80% of the population is black. 80% of blacks in terms of household income make 3,000 rand or less, less than $500. 98% of whites are in the top half of that scale. So it shows you that this that they're still so closely intertwined, and that's what leads to the current crisis in South Africa, that people realize that political liberation happened. One person, one vote was achieved in 1994, but that hasn't led yet to either social justice or economic freedom.
As I was reading your book, I was thinking about the Arab Spring, you know, the desire for more freedoms, for more democracy, for more civil and human rights, thinking about South Africa's struggle for those same things. And, you know, this is not particularly insightful, but just how hard it really is.
It is really hard, especially in a country where two big world historical forces arrived on the same day democracy did, and that is that the South African economy had been hived off from the world economy in the late stages of apartheid, was suddenly linked back up to a rapidly changing global capitalist economy. And the second big thing that walked in the door on the same day as democracy was the HIV pandemic. Mm. So even very wise leaders, wiser leaders than South Africa had, would have potentially been swamped by that cross-current of pressures. And that's part of the reason we still see this gap between the aspiration and the achievement.
Well, and looking at the AIDS epidemic in South Africa and looking at the last three presidents, Mandela, Mbeki, and the current president, Zuma, as you write, it seems that they either didn't grasp the seriousness of this epidemic or were unwilling to sort of acknowledge why it was there and what to do about it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, HIV all around the world has exposed the weaknesses of any society where it strikes. And the fact that this transition happened in the middle of the 90s as the epidemic was becoming a generalized epidemic spread through largely through heterosexual sex, of course, of the epidemic that hadn't been seen elsewhere in the world, really overwhelmed the system. And Mandela himself often says that if he ends up in hell rather than in the other place, that it will be because he failed to act strongly and quickly enough on HIV. With his successor, Thabo Mbeki, it was a different story. He did not believe the conventional medical science that HIV led to AIDS. He believed that if the government responded in the way he was being pressed to respond by people around the world, that he would completely destroy the revolution by taking all of the resources of the state and putting it in effect to buy pharmaceuticals for one disease. Zuma is a third case in which he's made so many ridiculous statements privately, but at the same time appointed a quite visionary health minister who has put into effect an excellent system of treatment and prevention that carries signs presently of beginning to turn the tide on the pandemic for the first time. So in each of those three presidencies, you see some successes, some denial, and now some real progress.
But what has been the overall impact of AIDS on South Africa?
It's devastating. You know, I lived through the first two waves of the epidemic in San Francisco. I belonged to a church in San Francisco that had 500 members, and in 2 years we had 500 funerals. You almost need to take that scale of what it felt like for those of your listeners who were around at that time in neighborhoods that were hard hit, and scale that up to a nationwide level to understand the effect on every single family. One in six young South Africans are estimated to be infected with HIV, and it was a huge trauma to lay over the trauma of apartheid and the violence of the late stages of the fight against apartheid, and it can't be minimized as part of the reason why this gap still exists between the vision that Nelson Mandela articulated and what's been achieved so far.
I'm curious about how effective President Bush's, I think it was a $15 billion AIDS initiative in Africa. Was it effective in any way, or perhaps even working in South Africa today?
You know, it's interesting because when I started going in 2004, most of the people among doctors and NGOs who were working on AIDS really turned up their nose at the PEPFAR initiative of George W. Bush. And within a year, we're getting large grants. I think the Bush administration deserves huge credit for PEPFAR for providing funds for medication at a time when international agencies were not stepping up quickly enough.
And did Nelson Mandela, did some of his, I hope I have this right, did some of his children die of AIDS?
Well, his son, Makoto, is the father of one of the six young people who stitched the narrative of this book together.
Right.
Indaba Mandela was the grandson of Nelson, who I spent quite a bit of time with and kind of gave me access to the thinking of the emerging black elite, but also to the Mandela family. Since he lives with his grandfather, he gave me access during a period when Nelson Mandela wasn't agreeing to be interviewed about what he was thinking. And yes, both his father and mother died of complications of AIDS, and Makoto died in the early weeks of 2005.
About a minute before our first break here, and Nelson Mandela is, what, 94 years old?
You got it exactly right. He's 94 years old. He's living in the village of Kunu, which is where he grew up before he escaped to Johannesburg to become a lawyer. He's said to be resting comfortably. He's quite frail and aging.
And is he still viewed, you know, as this great liberator?
Yeah, I think even young people who don't know the history of the struggle so well know Mandela as Tata, as grandfather. And so I think he's seen as grandfather of the nation, even if they don't know the exact year he went to prison. They know that for 27 years or so, for a big part of his life, he was imprisoned for his belief in one person, one vote, and for the political liberation of the country.
And that's Douglas Foster, our guest today on Radio Times. He's an associate professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, where he oversees the South African Journalism Residency Program. He's also a longtime journalist who's worked on a number of newspapers, magazines, TV, and documentaries. And he's also the author of a new book, which we are talking about, called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Tyler Parks Center for the Arts supports WHYY, presenting Crafts in the Meadow Fall Invitational Juried Craft Show, October 20th and 21st at Tyler State Park in Richboro, Bucks County. Crafts in the Meadow features works from more than 100 fine craftsmen, including jewelry, ceramics, glass, clothing, and more. Highlights include craft demonstrations, children's activities, and music from J.B. Klein, Greg Merkel, and others. Further details and a list of artists are available at tylerparkarts.org.
Virtua and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia's Pediatric Partnership is committed to providing quality care for children in South Jersey. CHOP at Virtua offers a child-friendly environment in Virtua's emergency rooms and children's inpatient units in Voorhees and Mount Holly, featuring pediatric specialists and advanced technology. And now open CHOP at Virtua's Pediatric Specialty Center and Sleep Care Center in Voorhees. More information online at virtua.org. Virtua is a proud supporter of WHYY.
Delaware Theater Company on the Wilmington Riverfront supports WHYY and presents The Outgoing Tide by Bruce Graham, October 10th to 28th. Starring Michael Learned, Ian Lithgow, and Peter Strauss, The Outgoing Tide offers surprising humor as it explores the ebb and flow of a family dynamic. Gunner has an unorthodox plan to secure his family's future, but meets with resistance from his wife and grown son. For tickets, 302-594-1100 or DelawareTheater.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Douglas Foster about his new book, After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. This is sort of half-quoting from one of the reviews of your book, but would it be fair to say that a black oligarchy has replaced a white one in South Africa?
I wouldn't say entirely replaced, because 80% of land, 80% of the country's wealth is still in white hands. But there certainly has been the emergence of a black elite in politics, in public life, and in some corporate life. That has created a distance between those new black corporate leaders and political leaders and the traditional base of the African National Congress, which is among the poor, the rural poor, and black professionals in the cities.
You write, though, about a compound outside of Pretoria where a lot of government officials, including the president, cabinet ministers, live there, and you describe it as a bucolic park-like setting with little traffic, no crime, clean air, and plenty of open space between the grand residences. No wonder they sometimes seem cut off from the daily realities of the people they governed.
Yeah, I was struck especially by that because I went to the compound to interview the president, President Zuma, right after the World Cup, and the last time I had seen him had been on the campaign trail in 2009, where we had been in small villages and where he had been demonstrating the kind of support he had from masses of poor South Africans and seemed very much in touch with their aspirations during that campaign. So to drive into what is essentially not just the White House, the residences of the president, but all the cabinet ministers, and mm-hmm. to see how in their daily life the key leaders of the country are really quite cut off from the realities that even wealthy and middle-class South Africans are facing.
And does that create problems for South Africa and for its government and for its people?
Well, I think it creates a big problem in terms of perception of those at the bottom, even if those cabinet ministers are regularly visiting and talking to their relatives and going to their homeland villages. Certainly the perception of people in the streets and in the villages is the thing that you've heard for quite some time on the street, which is the idea that the ANC is in office but not in power, and that people have taken these positions and taken the perks of these positions but not pushed up against the limitations and the constraints on their power to make real change for people at the bottom. Now, you know, millions of people have been lifted out of poverty by the ANC since 1994, and that shouldn't be overlooked because it's a difficult thing to do. 2 million black people have moved into middle income levels, but clearly not enough to tamp down the kind of frustration that's broken out in many places, including in the mines, in the last couple months.
And I do want to get to that, but you talk about a kind of division in South Africa between those who ride and those who walk.
I was so struck by that in the 2009 campaign. We were out, I was shadowing the president for a couple of days on the campaign trail, and we were in a village in Limpopo, one of the poorest provinces in the country, and there was a woman out in the crowd holding up a sign that said, Zuma, Black Jesus. And it made me realize how much this identification of Zuma as a kind of tribune of the people, as a former shoeless goat herd had risen to the level of president, how strong that feeling was out in that crowd. But I was struck by the fact that, of course, when it was over, he was ushered into a motorcade, and she walked home to a lean-to that had no electricity, no flush toilets, no running water.
You have had conducted several interviews with the current president of South Africa, President Zuma. He said that he never really wanted to be president, and nonetheless, here he is. What kind of a president is he?
It's a very mixed bag in his first term now. He has, as I said before, appointed a quite visionary minister of health. There are some ministries that are running better than ever. I think the general reputation and the reason that he's being challenged for leadership of the party in a vote that will come to fruition at the end of the year is that he's seen as somebody who perhaps has paid more attention to his personal life, to his various romances, and also to the economic benefit of his family and his friends than to the important job that has to be done.
I'm quoting from The Guardian, a recent article. Jacob Zuma, the president of South Africa, is facing an official investigation and public outcry over plans to upgrade his private residence and build a nearby town dubbed Zumaville at a cost of millions of pounds to the taxpayer.
I think the thing that really flummoxes who have watched him for years and have known him well are these kind of missteps of a program to, for example, build bunkers underneath his homestead location, and frankly, I can't understand it. I've known him since late 2006, and he was quite attentive to these steps that government officials made to upgrade their homes, to surround themselves with extra security, to get so removed from people. He used to get upset if he would walk into a stadium and the podium where he was going to speak was far away from people, because he knew that it created this perception of distance, when in fact his big selling point was that he understood the lives of average South Africans. So I think it's come as a surprise for people who have followed him for a long time, and certainly is going to be influential in this campaign now to try to drive him from office.
And why would someone need a bunker?
He said, apparently, this morning, although I haven't been able to track it down, he was reported to have said in a daily newspaper this morning in South Africa that he needed a bunker so that he could entertain foreign heads of state like Barack Obama. And it's just completely outrageous and unbelievable, because, of course, when heads of state come to visit, they come to visit in the official presidential residences. President Zuma has access to three of them, one in Durban, one in Cape Town, one in Pretoria. So none of it is passing the smell test, and I think it's quite damaging to him and to the party.
It seems that he has a different, or had a different background or upbringing compared to Mandela and Mbeki, in that he did come from poverty and it was not particularly well educated. Would that be a fair description?
Yeah, I think that the attraction to him, especially for rural people, in 2007, when he had his big fight with President Mbeki and ended up beating Mbeki for the presidency of the ANC, was that he had been a shoeless goat herd in a rural part of KwaZulu-Natal province, that he had had little formal education, that what education he had learning to read and write he had gotten in Robben Island, where he was imprisoned for 10 years, that what he knew he had learned from being in exile as a guerrilla leader and as chief of intelligence for the guerrilla wing of the party. I think he had an attraction as somebody who had not been imprisoned like Mandela, had not been educated like Mandela and Mbeki. Mbeki was in exile for 30 years, most of it spent in London, he had been in the frontline states. I think that his attraction to lots of people was that he had fought for the liberation of the country, and he would not lose touch with people at the bottom. And that's exactly the reputation that's being shaken now by these recent revelations of just the last few days.
And that's Douglas Foster. He's an associate professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, where he oversees the South African Journalism Residency Program. He's also the author of a new book, which we've been talking about, called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk about the strike this summer, but I also want to spend at least a little time talking about the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. I think many people, myself included, listened and watched as the games were played in South Africa. What did it mean for that country?
It was huge. I think it was as important in some ways in establishing a sense of self-respect for South Africans, and to feel that the world was once again paying attention to things other than cataclysms inside the country. As big as maybe 1994. I have never been in a situation, in a place where people seem to be floating on air. Because, of course, in the months leading up to the World Cup, there were all kinds of predictions that it was going to be a disaster. There were reports, particularly in European media outlets, that people should take their knife-proof vests, that the transportation systems were not going to work, that the stadiums weren't going to be completed. And by and large, if you look at the way the World Cup played out, it was flawless. The transportation was brilliant. The games were played well. Crime was under tight control, largely as a result of temporary hiring of tens of thousands of security officers. So I think it was huge, and I think partly what people are going through now is a little bit of a postpartum from that high, maybe similar to what people felt in the late 1990s after the feeling of having been so exhilarated at witnessing and living through the political liberation of their own country.
Did you go to any games?
I did.
And were they loud?
They were spectacular. I went to the last Ghana game, and It was packed to the rafters. Obviously, after South Africa was eliminated, there was a kind of Pan-Africanist support for what they called Gafana Fana, and it was stunning. Even though Ghana lost, it was an amazing game, and just astonishing to be in the streets and be in the townships at that time. One of the big questions I think black South Africans had, since sport, like everything in South Africa, is race-coded, was whether white people would come out for what had been a traditionally black sport. And there was a kind of awe, almost, that you could see on people's faces as lines of us would get off the buses, getting ready to go into the stadiums, that yes, white people had come together and supported the African teams as much as blacks had. I think it was probably as important as black support for rugby and Nelson Mandela's very famous appearance in 1995 at the Rugby World Cup, in which, even though it had been traditionally defined as a white sport, he arrived and made it a national imperative to win that Rugby World Cup.
Let me ask you about the mine workers' strike this summer. Something like 34 strikers were killed by the police protesting conditions, I guess, at these particular mines. I guess, tell us what happened and the significance of what all that means.
It's huge, and it's important to us on this side as well. Platinum, it was a platinum mine, the Lonmin mine, and platinum is the new gold. It's used in everything from the catalytic converter in your car to jewelry. South Africa sits on 80% of the reserves of platinum, so it links us economically, even if we don't care about the politics. 34 wildcat strikers were killed by the police in a confrontation, and 50 people actually have been killed in the last couple months overall in those strikes. What's happening is a wave of labor disputes, not just in platinum, but in gold, diamonds, chrome, iron ore, and even in coal, which is critical. And it has to do with what we began the hour talking about, that gap between what was promised and what was achieved. So there's wildcat strikes over wages and conditions in some of these mines, which are very, very deep shafts. And the significance, you know, clearly from a historical point of view, is that apartheid was really largely brought down by a series of strikes in the late 1980s. Hundreds of thousands of people in the gold mines went out on strike, largely for political reasons. But that forced the former white minority regime to the negotiating table. And so, of course, with this kind of rising labor furor at the bottom, the question is whether the ANC government is capable of keeping the lid on.
Well, and what has been the government response, or even the response from the president?
Huge. Zuma went right away, appointed an interministerial commission. I think, if I remember right, seven top cabinet ministers were there, basically moved to the area for a week and a half. There is an ongoing investigation of exactly what happened. That's a presidentially appointed commission. And despite these steps, the strikes have spread to other sectors. There's a large unrelated trucker strike going on now, and you just see this pent-up frustration over unemployment among people who are unemployed and over low wages among those who are employed.
I was reading that 12,000 of the miners were fired. Is that correct?
Well, they've been told that they've been fired by Angloplats, which is another platinum mining company. I don't think that company will be able to make those firings stick, because the wildcatters have continued to enforce what has been a quite violent strike, and most of those mines are not operating. So I'd be very surprised whether those announcements turn out to be either useful in getting a tone of negotiation that leads to those mines operating again happens or not.
Who owns the mines?
Well, they're largely owned by large multinational concerns. The Lonmin mine, where the mass shooting happened in August, is owned by a London company, London-based company, and of course that is a big question on the not just the minds but the lips of populists who say it's time to nationalize these mines if they can't be forces in the economic and social development of the country, then we ought to take them over.
That's Douglas Foster, and again, an associate professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, oversees the South African Journalism Residency Program. He's been a longtime journalist, has written for a number of publications, including The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, The LA Times, Smithsonian, and a former editor of Mother Jones, and he's also the author of a new book, which we've been talking about, called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Lines open, any questions or comments? We've covered a fair amount of territory and history. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Museum supports WHYY. Ancient artifacts recently excavated at the World Heritage Site of Copan, Honduras, are featured in the new exhibition Maya 2012, Lords of Time. Towering replicas of monuments and interactive experiences invite visitors to another time and place. Did the Maya believe the world would end this year? Explore predictions of an apocalypse and their supposed origins in the ancient Maya civilization. More at penn.museum/2012.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, The Beginning, Yannick Nézet-Séguin in his inaugural concert as music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Renee Fleming joins Yannick for this gala event. Opening night tickets at 215-893-1999 and at philorg.org. Thursday, October 18th, one performance only at the Kimmel Center. Renee Fleming joins Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra for their inaugural gala concert.
Supporting WHYY, Devon Prep, a private Catholic college preparatory school for young men in grades 6 through 12. At Devon Prep, every student is encouraged to excel in the classroom, on the ball field, and in the community. Devon Prep strives to prepare young men to be compassionate, responsible leaders able to face the challenges of life with confidence. Their open house is Sunday, October 14th from 1 to 4 p.m. on their mainline campus in Devon. More at devonprep.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Half the population of South Africa is under the age of 25. Our guest, Douglas Foster, spent almost a decade traveling to and living in South Africa. He spent a fair amount of time interviewing government leaders, talking with South Africans about their hopes and fears for their country. And his new book is called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Are you worried about the future of South Africa, Douglas?
I'm worried, but I'm also inspired. I've spent now the last couple years in group interviews with 40% of the population that's 18 and under. Right. And in spite of all of the constraints that we've been talking about, there's a high level of optimism in that generation. 57% of young South Africans say their lives will be better than their parents. And I think if we look at the constraints only, that sort of cataclysm side of the narrative, it's hard to understand that. On the other hand, they've seen their parents and their grandparents live through an extraordinary transition. And I think that leads to the search on their part for the wiggle room in the world economy to try to close the gap, the inequality gap that that their generation inherited.
And I assume this is the group that will eventually be running South Africa.
This is the group very shortly that will be running the country, and I think they're primed for that. I think, in fact, what you're beginning to see in youth organizations all over the place is a plea for this older generation, including President Zuma, who's now 70 years old, to clear the field and to leave it to a generation of people maybe not so marked by the apartheid past or marked by the struggle against apartheid, and perhaps as a result of that, better able to get a fix on what the current challenges are and to move on them. I mean, in some ways, meeting these young South Africans over the course of the last couple years has led me to think about a question all of us face all the time on a personal level or a political level, which is, what are the conditions under which we get kind of swamped by our own history, either as a person or as a country? And what are the conditions under which some people, some of the time, escape history's grasp? And young South Africans are looking for those openings, for that wiggle room, even in the current international climate in which inequality is opening up everywhere, to close that gap and get closer to the non-racial, non-sexist, non-homophobic, and more egalitarian society that was promised them 18 years ago.
And not to throw cold water on all those aspirations, but as you also do describe, it is a country of extraordinary beauty and opportunity, but also, again, quoting from you, sprawling slums, mired in poverty, many of the people living in the countryside lacking the most basic infrastructure, high unemployment. It's a fairly long list and a fairly big challenge for this younger generation.
It is. It's huge, and of course, it's a challenge that implicates us as well, because we're part of an international economic system which has systematically made it somewhat more difficult for developing countries to create ladders of social mobility that would help people find their way out of that kind of poverty.
Which includes what? Education, opportunity?
Well, and constraints even on being able to protect the auto industry and textile industry that was absolutely flattened by exports from the Chinese. If you don't have these sectors, if you're not able to protect sectors that allow people to enter middle-income lives, it's very hard to, or impossible even, to close that gap and to make up for the inequalities that were created under apartheid.
How would you describe the relationship then between South Africa and the United States?
It's been close, the relationship, even in changing administrations. I think that the ANC felt quite close to the administration of George W. Bush in some ways, and then quite at odds with that administration over the war in Iraq, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think the relationship with Secretary Clinton and President Obama has been even closer.
I do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about not the United States this hour. We spent a fair amount of time this year talking about some of the challenges facing this country. We are talking about South Africa and talking with Douglas Foss, who has written a new book called After Mandela. This is the New York Times today. The headline reads, South Africa has a black idol. The surprise is that it's a first. And apparently they have their own version of American Idol. I guess it's South African Idol. And for the first time, the winner was black as opposed to white. Is this significant, do you think?
Yeah, I think all of these firsts are important. And especially sometimes looking at South Africa from the outside, because so many of us saw the struggle against apartheid as an extension of the civil rights movement, we think of it as sort of a minority moment. But it's important to realize the demography is sort of reversed. Mm-hmm. So 75% to 80% of the population is black. And to have a show like that in which you would even say, have to say, the first winner is black is so odd from that point of view. So, yes, all of these firsts are really important. Of course, it was important that the first black president was elected and the first one-person, one-vote situation in 94. And, you know, as we know in this country, social and political, social relations often lag behind political changes, and all of these social changes that lead to singers and theater and music that crosses those racial lines are important in creating a sense of being South African, being non-racial.
And sometimes culture and pop culture, you know, is ahead of politics as well.
Sure, sure. I think a lot these days about a wonderful black singer named Brenda Fassie, who was one of the first crossover stars in South African life. And all during the 1980s, she got away with singing this song, My Black President, during a period when it was illegal to mention the name of Nelson Mandela or to put his name in print or to circulate his photograph. She sang My Black President. Everybody knew who she was singing about. The apartheid regime maybe was wise enough not to imprison her for doing that. And so you're quite right that you see sometimes in culture the seed of what's going to happen in other realms. And I think we do see in the theater, in the dance, in the films, in the soap operas being made by young South Africans, a kind of yearning for the original vision of the national liberation movement for this multiracial, non-racial, and non-sexist kind of attitude.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Martin from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. And Martin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
When I visited South Africa about nine, 10 years ago, I noticed that apartheid was no longer being practiced, but also that there had been no change in the ownership of important things like buildings and businesses and factories and so forth, that those were still owned by the previous owners, the whites.
And you want to know if that's still true today, Martin?
Yes. And also, changing things means not only changing apartheid laws, but also having some kind of integration of ownership. I had noticed this in the American South during the civil rights struggle when I was there some years ago, that the changes had taken place. It was no longer apartheid. You could sit any place on a bus, but the ownership of businesses and real estate and everything was still largely owned by the Southern whites.
Well, Martin, that's a very interesting comment. Let me give our guest, Douglas Foster, a chance to respond. Thanks for calling, Martin. Your thoughts, Douglas?
Yeah, I think, Martin, if he went back today, would see that some corporations now, as a result of black economic empowerment policies and so on, have more blacks in ownership. But I think he would still be struck by the fact that 80% of the wealth, 80% of the land is still in white hands. And, of course, that goes back to the agreement that the ANC struck when it came into power through a negotiated settlement, not through a revolution, which was to basically to trade away for the right to elect a government, an agreement not to restructure the economy and not to do radical redistribution. And I think the populace out there, including the former leader of the ANC Youth League, Julius Malema, are getting a following on the line that 18 years is a long time to wait, and now maybe this slower, less militant approach has not worked.
Martin, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Douglas, since you work with journalists and you are a journalist as well, just how free is the press in South Africa?
It's free. It's quite independent, and it's under a threat at the moment from a law that has been promulgated by the ANC called the Protection of State Information Bill. I actually had an argument on the presidential jet with President Zuma about this bill the last time I saw him, and he got quite agitated. It would provide prison sentences for revealing state secrets, and when we got into the argument, he said every place in the world is going in the direction of protecting state secrets more effectively. Your president, meaning President Obama, has been quite strict on this point. So I think quite independent, quite free, actually quite good by world standards, I would say, and under this threat of being seen as somehow counter-revolutionary by people who are supporters of the ANC.
Did President Zuma have a point when he talked about President Obama and secrets in this country?
Yeah, of course. We have seen a trend around the world, partly because of what governments are always inclined to do, take any opportunity to make more information secret than less secret. And also, I think, we who work in the media have been ill-served by Murdoch and by the tabloids, who have made us more vulnerable to the charge that we don't care about the dignity of human beings, that we trample on other people's rights. And I think that's made us more vulnerable to these attempts by governments to restrict us.
Do you have a favorite place in South Africa?
I love Johannesburg. When I went to South Africa, all of my friends who had been international correspondents kept saying to me, "How much time are you going to are you going to get to stay in Cape Town, and how many days are you going to have to be in Johannesburg? They saw it as kind of a crime-ridden pit. It's the most treed urban area in the world. The combination of townships, informal settlements, urbanized settings, I found just really invigorating. The ability to go to a place where you'll hear spoken word in maybe four of South Africa's 11 official languages and more or less get the sense of what's going on. The chance to see and to be around an Africanized, modernizing, cosmopolitan center was a year that I will never forget. And it's being around it and living in it is what gives me some cautious optimism and hope about the future for South Africa.
And how close did you get to interviewing Nelson Mandela?
Well, I saw him several times, but by the time I started coming in 2004, he had announced that he would do no more interviews because he felt that his memory was beginning to fade, and he didn't want to be put on the spot to answer questions. The last time I saw him was after the World Cup. I was visiting Indaba Mandela, his grandson, and Indaba offered me and my son a chance to spend some time with the old man, as he calls him. So we did go in and spend a little bit of time with him, and he, you know, his hearing was gone, but that same magnificent smile was there, and he greeted us by saying what I'm sure he says to a lot of people, oh, it's very nice that young people would come and see an old man who has nothing new to say.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You don't hear that kind of humility from world leaders. Well, Douglas Foster, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It was a real pleasure to be with you, Marty. A
pleasure for us as well. And he's the author of a new book called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. He's an associate professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. He oversees the South African Journalism Residency Program. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. In fact, if you want to get a full experience online, including in-studio photos and conversation highlights, your comments, and more, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and again, visiting our website, whyy.org/radiotimes. That website expanded and improved. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.